Well, good evening. How we doing? Woo. All right, we're just okay. All right, good. Hey, let's thank Logan and friends for leading us tonight, man. That was awesome. That was so great. So cool. Man, how awesome is this to be together in Baylor Ballpark lifting up the name of Jesus? That's a good thing, huh? Okay, all right. Tough crowd tonight. Cool. It's going to be a fun one. Well, hey, if we've never been together before, my name is Timothy Atik. I'm the Executive Director of Vertical Ministries here in Waco, Texas. And if this is your first time at Vertical, let me just say welcome. So glad that you made the trip across the street to be here tonight. If you have been around Vertical a little bit, then you probably are aware that my favorite movie quote of all times comes from the movie Braveheart. If you've never seen the movie Braveheart, watch it before your next intramural game, okay? Because you will win, I promise. You will. You'll be so amped. You'll be cussing at people in a Scottish accent, and it'll just, you'll win, and it'll be good for you. But in Braveheart, William Wallace makes this phenomenal statement. And I use it in Vertical a lot, but I want to share it with you tonight because it has everything to do with what we're talking about. William Wallace comes to this moment in the movie where he says this. He says, "Every man dies. Not every man really lives." That's terrible. I'm sorry, but we just try it in a normal English accent. He says this, and listen, this is so significant. It has so much to do with what we're talking about tonight. He says, "Every man dies, not every man really lives." And I love that quote because I think it's saying something significant. It's saying this: death is inevitable, but life is not. Death is inevitable, but life is not. The reality is that every single person in this place is passionate to experience, passionate about experiencing a life that is truly fulfilling, right? Every single person here, it doesn't matter what your religious background is, it has nothing to do with that. The fact of the matter is that every single one of us is relentless about experiencing a life that is full of love and joy and peace and adventure and pleasure. We all want that. Last week, I introduced you to the scale of life, and I said this: if on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being no life at all, 10 being life to the full, this semester, where do you hope to land on the scale? Just think about that question real quick. If you were here last week, you answered it. Answer it again. Where do you hope to land? It doesn't matter who you are. Every single one of us hopes to settle in somewhere around an 8, 9, or 10 this semester. No one here sets their sights on mediocrity. But if William Wallace is correct, many of us here in this stadium tonight will blast out into this semester longing to, hoping to experience a life that is truly fulfilling. And in the end, you're going to find a life that is actually frustratingly empty. I said it last week and I'll say it again. If you want to be someone who goes through life and truly lives, then you better be extremely careful where you look to find life this semester. You better be extremely careful where you look to find life. Here's the good news. The good news is that the book of Ecclesiastes in the Bible exists to help us navigate our way to a life that is truly fulfilling. So if you have a Bible, I want you to turn with me tonight to Ecclesiastes chapter 2. If you don't have a Bible, that's completely fine. We're going to have all of the text right back there on the big scoreboard. But turn with me to Ecclesiastes chapter 2. We established last week that most likely Solomon is the author of Ecclesiastes, and here's the great thing about Solomon. Solomon is more passionate than we are to experience a life that is truly fulfilling. He actually despises the idea of living life somewhere between a 1 and a 7. He abhors a life that is empty and frustrating and meaningless. He longs to experience a life somewhere around an 8, 9, or 10. So what we see in the book of Ecclesiastes, especially in chapters 1 and 2, is that Solomon scrutinizes everything under the sun, looking for life. Let's just jump right in, right here in verse 1. Chapters 1 and 2, Solomon is scrutinizing everything under the sun. We established last week that under the sun is one of Solomon's favorite phrases. It's a reference to everything in the confines of the observable world. It removes God from the equation. So when Solomon is searching for life, he is exploring everything under the sun. He tells us right here in verse 1 what he's going to experiment with. Chapter 2 is known as Solomon's grand experiment, and he tells us right here in verse 1 what he's going to be experimenting with. Look with me. Verse 1, it says this, "I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself." That word test in the Hebrew, it's the idea of conducting an experiment. Solomon says, I want to conduct an experiment with pleasure. I want to know what effect pleasure will have on every single part of me, my body, my mind, my soul. I want to know if when you mix my body, my mind, my soul with hedonism, which is the pursuit of pleasure, hedonism makes gratification ultimate. Solomon, in a sense, puts on his lab coat, heats up the Bunsen burners, makes sure that the eye washing station is working properly, steps into the lab and says, I want to know what happens when I mix these two elements, hedonism and himself. He wants to know if when those two elements are mixed, if they're actually going to produce fulfillment. And Solomon shows us right here in verse 1 that he would be an absolutely terrible TV producer. Because instead of trying to build this suspense towards his findings, before he even unpacks the experiment, he just tells us what he's found in verse 1. Look with me. Verse 1 and 2, he says this. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. I said of laughter, it's mad, and of pleasure, what use is it? So we established last week that one of Solomon's favorite words is the word vanity. It's the Hebrew word hevel. Do you remember what we said about hevel? If you weren't here, let me just unpack it for you. Hevel, it literally means breath or vapor. You think about the steam that comes out of your mouth on a cold day. It's referring to something that's very fleeting. It's there 1 minute and gone the next, like the steam coming out of your mouth. But the word hevel also carries with it the idea of frustration caused by emptiness. So do you remember, if you were here, what I did is I pulled out this dollar bill, or last week it was a $10 bill, and we played the game. And if you've never played it and you're looking for something to do at 1 a.m, you probably need to play it. But you take this bill and you get your friend and you make them put their hands like this and you say, you can have the money if you can catch the money, and you drop it and they never can get it. It's amazing. It is absolutely incredible if you're the one dropping the money, because what you see happen is the person you're playing with, they build up confidence. With every try, they start thinking, this is the time that I'm actually going to grasp the money. And it is so frustrating that every single time you try and grab the stinking money, and you always come up empty. When Solomon says vanity, when he uses the word hevel, that's what he means. He's talking about that frustratingly empty feeling that you experience when you try and grasp for the money, the money that's fleeting. It's there 1 minute and gone the next, and all you do is come up empty. Right here in verse 1, he says, I tested pleasure. I experimented with pleasure. And let me just tell you what I found. I found that pleasure, the pursuit of fulfillment through pleasure, is actually frustratingly empty. Again, he'd be an awful TV producer because he's already told us his findings before he's unpacked the experiment. But now in verses 3 through 10, he unpacks the experiment, and it is fascinating. Look at it with me. Let me just read you verses 3 through 10. Look at what Solomon did to test pleasure. Verse 3, I love this. He says, I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom in how to lay hold of folly. So what that just says right there is Solomon is somehow the center of the party, yet he's the dork in the lab coat taking notes at the same time, like standing by the keg, like, oh, I see you've had 3 beers. Interesting. Okay, noted. All right, so that's what it's saying. It's saying, I tried to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom. And I tried to lay hold of folly till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. He goes on, he says this, I made great works. I built houses, planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I had also great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the sons of man. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me, and whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure. That's his experiment. Now, before we kind of unpack his experiment a little, let me just tell you what my fear is. My fear is that you are going to look at Solomon's experiment and something in you is going to try and downplay or diminish what Solomon did just because it happened 3,000 years ago. Like, for example, if you and Solomon were somehow on the movie Hot Rod and you introduced yourself and you were like, hey, my name's Mark and I like to party. And Solomon was like, my name's Solomon and I also like to party. My fear is that you'd hear that and be like, Solomon, you say you like to party, but I don't think you've ever partied. You're going to downplay it because it happened 3,000 years ago. You look and say, well, Solomon, you're kind of 2,000 late, all right? Like, that was a long time ago. You just don't have, you can't compare what you did 3,000 years ago to today. Well, let me just, I want to make sure that you can kind of grasp the scope of Solomon's experiment. So let me just read you 2 passages from 1 Kings so you can kind of get your mind around what we're talking here. 1 Kings chapter 4, verses 22 through 23 tell us this about Solomon. It says this, Solomon's provision for one day. This is Solomon's daily provision. Provision for one day was 30 cores of fine flour and 60 cores of meal. We don't have any clue what that means, okay? It goes on, it says this, 10 fat oxen, 20 pasture-fed cattle, 100 sheep, besides deer, gazelles, roebucks, and fattened fowl. Okay, that was his provision for one day. Commentators believe that that is enough provision for at least 5,000 people, if not somewhere close to 10 to 15,000 people, is what Solomon has for just one day. Later in 1 Kings, the Queen of Sheba comes to visit Solomon. So just so you get what's happening, royalty is coming to visit royalty. And here's what the Queen of Sheba says. It says, when the Queen of Sheba had seen all of the wisdom of Solomon, the house that he had built, the food of his table, the seating of his officials, and the attendance of his servants, their clothing, his cupbearers, and his burnt offerings that he offered at the house of the Lord, there was no more breath in her. You realize what this is saying? This is saying that the Queen of Sheba is, who is royalty, is speechless because of the whole nother level of Solomon's royalty. What this tells us is that when Solomon steps into this experiment with pleasure, he doesn't mess around. Solomon does not joke around. He doesn't do anything half bottom, all right? He does not joke around, all right? Everything he does, he goes all out for it. Let's just walk back through the experiment, just kind of get our minds around what happens. Solomon starts by saying that he tries to cheer his body with wine. He tries to take hold of folly. So Solomon begins his experiment with epic parties. Now, I don't know what needs to happen at a party for you to label it as epic, but just to be clear on what's going on here, maybe when you party, you pack out a backyard with 100 people. When Solomon partied, he was packing out the palace complex with 10 to 15,000 people every single night. When you party, you roll in a keg of Natty Light or Keystone, the cheap stuff. When Solomon partied, he rolled in the fanciest barrels of wine from his private vineyards. When you party, you drink out of a red solo cup. When Solomon and his friends party, they're all drinking out of gold goblets. No joke. When you party, you push play on an iTunes playlist that's playing out of some janky sound system. When Solomon partied, he had Macklemore and JT on retainer. He's like, JT, it's your night. Get out there. Man, when you party, some of you would consider it a success if you hook up with one girl. Solomon had 700 wives and 300 concubines who were ready to hook up with him at any time. You think BSR on Dia was epic? It looked like a little kid's birthday party compared to Solomon's parties. Just so you grasp what we are talking about here with Solomon's experiment. It goes on and it says that he built houses, plural. Some of the nicest houses in Highland Park or Westlake or Memorial might take somewhere between 2, 3, 4 years to build. Solomon spent 13 years on his palace. You realize that's almost double the amount of time that he spent working on God's house, the temple. The text goes on and it says not only did he have houses, plural, but he had, he planted vineyards, plural. He had gardens and parks, plural. That word parks, interestingly, is the Hebrew word pardes, which is has some association with the Persian word paradisia, where we ultimately get our word paradise from. So you know what's happening here? Solomon is actually trying to reconstruct the Garden of Eden, paradise. He said, I made for myself pools, plural, from which to water the forest of growing trees. You know what he's saying here? He's saying, your little 1,000-acre ranch, that's cute. I owned a forest. He says, I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. He's saying, I had slaves who had slaves who had slaves. I literally had to do nothing. When I woke up in the morning, there was an extravagant breakfast just there. When I wanted to get dressed, someone picked out my clothes and put them on me. When I wanted a snack, I just told someone, get me a snack. When I wanted to party, I told people it's time to party, and someone got the stuff together and then cleaned it up when I was done. I literally did not have to lift a finger. Goes on, he says this. He says, I had also great possessions of herds and flocks more than anyone who had been before me in Jerusalem. I had also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasures of kings and provinces. People estimate that Solomon's yearly income was over $1 billion, and that doesn't include the gifts that kings would bring him when they would come to check out just how wise he really was. He says, I got singers, both men and women. So you hop on iTunes to buy a song. Solomon bought the bands. You're mine. Said he had many concubines. I already said that he had 700 wives, 300 concubines. It is safe to conclude that Solomon had more sex than anyone here will ever have. Period. Period. He goes on, he says this, so I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Okay, we've talked about this before, but there's something in us that always strives to have the factor over people. We want to know that we are smart-er, strong-er, pretty-er, skinny-er, funny-er, crazy-er, successful-er than other people. Solomon didn't have to strive for the er factor because he already had the est factor. He was known as wise-ist, wealthy-ist, strong-ist. Said this, whatever, this is like the catch-all of his experiment. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure. You know what he's saying? He's saying, I never said no to myself. If I wanted something, I took it. If I wanted to build something, I built it. If I wanted to eat something, I ate it. If I wanted to sleep with a certain woman, I slept with that woman. If I wanted to buy something, I bought it. I never said no to myself. After all of this, look at what he says in verse 11. He reminds us of his conclusion. He says this, then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I had expended in doing it, and behold, all was vanity and a striving after wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. You know what he's saying? He's saying, I tested pleasure, and in the end, it felt like I was playing tag with the wind. It's ridiculous. It's frustratingly empty. I worked my butt off to get to this place where I felt like I had everything. And when I felt like I had everything, I realized I was missing the one thing that I truly wanted, which was fulfillment, a truly fulfilling life. I got to the end, and my life was frustratingly empty. You want to know why pleasure can be very frustrating and empty? Is because pleasure always demands more pleasure. It does. Pleasure always demands more pleasure. I mean, some of you guys hear that Solomon had 700 wives and 300 concubines, and you're dreaming. I mean, you're just dreaming about it. You're like, that is like, I don't know what heaven's going to be like, but that could be my heaven. Like, a different woman in my bed every night of the week. Like, I cannot fathom that. But the reality is, you do kind of get to experience that. You, in a sense, can have a different woman in your bed every night of the week through pornography. Do you ever wonder why, slowly over time, you have to look at more provocative, more explicit, more adventurous material over time to stay interested, to be satisfied? The reason is pleasure always demands more pleasure. You never, if you think about a cup, with pleasure, the cup is never full. When you start getting full, pleasure just says there's a bigger cup. And it's empty, and you need to start working on filling that one up. Pleasure always demands more pleasure. As I was preparing for this message, it was kind of crazy. I was looking at Twitter, and this article came across ESPN on Twitter, and it was about Jerry Jones, who is the owner of the Dallas Cowboys. He's also Dallas Cowboys, and he's also the general manager. And I couldn't believe it, because when I clicked on the article, listen to what I read. Here's what it said about Jerry Jones. This was the little blurb at the top. It said, in the owner's suite, on his private jet, or among Dallas's beautiful people, Jerry Jones seems a happy man, but what he really wants, he cannot have. And as I read the article, I couldn't believe it, because I was looking at a modern-day Solomon. The article started by talking about how 71-year-old Jerry Jones is the owner of the most valuable franchise, the Cowboys, which are worth $3.2 billion. The article talked about how Jerry Jones loves to drink his Johnny Walker Blue Label whiskey. His $1.25 billion stadium is referred to in the article as the Pleasure Palace. In his private box in the stadium during the George Strait concert, the article says, Jones and his friends were knocking down whiskey, dancing, and talking about making money. Back home in his $20 million mansion in Highland Park, the article talks about the painting on his wall worth $18.5 million. He has security guards and people who wait on him at home and bring him what he needs. On top of all of that, he's known as the Honky Tonk Man because of his long reputation as a womanizer. Even at 71, he's able to pull the ladies in. I mean, this is a modern-day Solomon. Do you see it? He's got the parties, the palace, the stuff, the women, significance. Yet despite all of this, listen to what the article goes on and says. It says this. After a quarter century as Cowboys owner, general manager, and the architect of the stadium that has become a spit-shined monument to every Texas-sized aspiration, something big is still missing for Jones. As elusive now as it was then, to be widely regarded as a smart football man. And then the article quotes Jones as saying this, I've never wanted anything as much as I want to win the next Super Bowl. Jones says, smiling, You wouldn't want to see the size of check that I would write if it would for sure get the Dallas Cowboys a Super Bowl. The article goes on and says this, the one thing he wants most is the only thing he cannot buy. Do you see it? I mean, the crazy thing about all of this is he's longing for a Super Bowl win. Jerry Jones has already won three Super Bowls with the Cowboys. But pleasure always demands more pleasure. The more you have, the more you want. That's the way it goes. I'm going to say something right now, and I hope that you will hear it. And I want you to know I'm saying it with as much love as I can. But many of you here are going to live incredibly predictable lives. Your life is going to be so predictable that it's going to be the life that the Bible wrote about 3,000 years ago. Mark my words, some of you guys 30 years from today are going to look back and be like, that guy in Baylor Ballpark predicted my life to a T. This is going to be your life. You're going to party hard through college. You're going to graduate. You're going to get a job, and you're going to make something of yourself, and you're going to work your butt off, but you're going to make a lot of money doing it. You're going to have nice cars. You're going to have a box or a suite in McLean Stadium, and you're going to have houses, plural. You're going to have a big house in Dallas or Houston or Austin. You're going to have a lake house out at Cedar Creek or LBJ or Conroe. You're going to have a ski house in Beaver Creek. You're going to get to a point where everyone, you don't have to lift a finger. People do everything for you. There's people who take care of your landscape, people who cook your meals, people who clean your house even when it's spotless, and people who do all the work for your company while you play golf. And even in the midst of having all of that, it is not going to be enough. Mark my word. You want to know why? Because you're going to look for life in pleasure, and pleasure refuses to fulfill. Because pleasure always demands more pleasure. You're going to live on this treadmill of wondering if it's going to fulfill, and it's not. And you're just going to keep running and running, hoping you're going to get to this point where you're fulfilled. It's not going to happen. And I say that with love. The experiment doesn't end there. It keeps going in verse 12, but it takes this weird turn, and I want you to see it real quickly. It takes this weird turn, and I love that it takes this turn because it's going to invite some people into the conversation who haven't felt a part of the conversation yet, because you've heard this experiment with the partying and all the money, all the stuff, all the women, and you haven't felt a part of it because you're like, that's just not really me. So watch how the experiment, Solomon tweaks it in a big way. He says this, I turn to consider wisdom and madness and folly, for what can the man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. Then I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than in folly, as there is more gain in light than in darkness. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. You know what he's saying? He gets to this point where he just decides to settle down. He's tired of the hangovers. He's tired of waking up in his own forest, wondering how he got there. He's tired of the drama. He's tired of all of it. And so he just decides, man, I want to settle down. I want to stop just throwing money away. I'm gonna start thinking about life. I wanna act with wisdom. I have the most wisdom of anyone in the world. So what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna settle down and I'm gonna try and be wise through life. If you're here and you're a goody-goody or kind of more of the rule follower type, Solomon is saying, I wanna be like you. Maybe fulfillment isn't found in the pursuit of pleasure. Maybe fulfillment is found by getting to the end of your life and looking back and saying, man, I did life well. I lived a wise and moral life. Look at his conclusion about that. He says, yet I perceive that the same event happens to all of them. Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart that this also is vanity. For of the wise as of the fool, there is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come, all will have been long forgotten. How the wise dies just like the fool. So I hated life because what is done under the sun was grievous to me. For all is vanity and a striving after wind. He's saying, man, I did the wise thing. I did the moral thing. And you know what I realized? I realized that the idiot and the smart guy get the same reward at the end of their lives. There's no reward ceremony at the end of your life where people are handing out first, second, and third place medals for the wisest and most moral life. No, everyone gets the same reward, a box in the ground. Saying it's vanity. It is frustratingly empty. That's the conclusion that he comes to of his experiment. It's like, man, I've tried it. Like I tried pleasure. It was empty. I stepped away from pleasure. I did the smart thing, the wise thing. It was empty. And then in verse 18, it's like he's already finished the experiment. He's already given us his conclusion, but now he's just rambling on about his findings. He's just spiraling downward in despair. So if you think Solomon has already been the Debbie Downer, just watch this. Like he's just gonna keep beating us over the head with depression and despair. Listen to this. And I say it with a smile on my face, which just isn't right, all right? Here's what he says. He says, verse 18, I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool, yet he will be master of all for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity. So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labors under the sun. Because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow and his work is a vexation. Even in the night, his heart does not rest. This also is vanity. He just beats us over the head with his despair. He's basically saying, here's what you do. You work your butt off. You stay up all night worrying about your work. You work and you work and you work. And then you get to the departure gate of life, which is death. And you know what they come over the intercom and say? No carry-on bags, no checked bags. You leave this world the same way you entered it, empty-handed. You want to know how frustratingly empty life is under the sun? He's saying it doesn't matter what you accumulate, what you achieve, you have to check all of it at the door, and you let some yahoo enjoy it who didn't have to do jack squat for it. That's how frustratingly empty life is. I want everyone in here to take a deep breath before we read verse 24. Someone just went, that's not what I was asking you to do. All right. Here we go, verse 24. I hope you're ready for it. Most important verses I'll read tonight. There is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he has given the business of gathering and collecting only to give it to the one who pleases God. This also is vanity and a striving after wind. You know that feeling when you get on an airplane and maybe you're a little sick, like you have congestion? So as you ascend, the pressure builds in your ears. You know what I'm talking about? Like the pressure just builds. Maybe you can feel it right now as I talk about it. It builds and it builds and it builds. So you put gum in and you're chewing your gum and you keep yawning. Yawning's contagious, you know. You're yawning, you're cocking your jaw, trying to get it to pop, and it won't pop. You know that misery? How glorious is it when the pressure finally pops? You know that feeling? Where you hear clearly for the first time the whole flight? Verse 24 is the pop. For 23 verses, Solomon has been building up the pressure of despair that comes from looking for life under the sun. He wants us to be uncomfortable. He wants us to be miserable. Why? So that the pop that comes when we turn our gaze beyond the sun will be so beautiful. You know what he's saying here? He's saying life is possible. Joy is possible. Fulfillment is possible. But you're going to have to look to God, who is beyond the sun, to find it. Blaise Pascal put it this way. He said, there's a God-shaped vacuum in the heart of every man, which cannot be filled by any created thing, but only by God, the Creator, made known through Jesus Christ. That's why Jesus says in John 10:10, I came that they may have life and have it to the full. John 6:35, he says this, I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me shall not hunger. Whoever believes in me shall never thirst. He's saying you'll be fulfilled. That's why in John 8:12, he says, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of what? Of life. John 11:25, he says, I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And whoever believes in me, though he lives, shall never die. You know what Jesus is saying? If you want to be someone who goes through life and truly lives, it's going to have everything to do with me, Jesus Christ. Let me tell you the decision that you need to make tonight, which will impact the rest of your semester, and honestly, the rest of your life. This is the question that you need to answer tonight. this semester, are you going to view pleasure as a gift or as a god? That's the decision you need to make tonight. This semester, are you going to view pleasure as a gift or as a god? Think about it. If sex is a gift from God, then it's great to have, but you don't have to have it. Like you can survive your life without having sex. Some guys here are like, well, it's debatable. No one can know for sure. No, I'm pretty sure. But if it's a gift, it's great to have, but you don't have to have it. Sex can simply be the icing on the cake to a already sweet emotional and spiritual connection between a husband and a wife. You don't need sex to determine whether you're manly or powerful or significant or loved or fulfilled. If money and stuff is a gift from God, then it's great to have, but you don't have to have it. Money and stuff can simply be tools that you use to have fun and bless others. But you don't need it to determine your worth or whether you're significant in society. If alcohol is just a gift from God, then it's nice to have, but you don't have to have it. Alcohol can just be something that you use legally and in moderation to enjoy a nice meal or to enjoy a get-together with friends. But you don't need it to fit in or to help people like you more. If position and popularity are just a gift from God, then it's nice to have, but you don't have to have it. If you have position and popularity, it can be something that you simply use to help further the name of Jesus Christ. That's God giving you a platform to display his love even more, but you don't need it to determine whether you're really valuable at this school or in society. See, if you view pleasure as just a gift from God, then you don't have to bank on the gift for fulfillment. You can bank on the giver of the gift for fulfillment. But let me tell you this, and I hope you don't miss this. If you view pleasure as your God this semester, if sex is your God, if stuff is your God, if achievement is your God, if popularity is your God, if alcohol is your God this semester, you need to know you're trying to hydrate with salt water. You are. The more you drink, the more thirsty you will be. Why? Because pleasure always demands more pleasure. Period. How are you going to view pleasure this semester? You're either going to view it as a gift or as a god. I'll finish by saying this. My wife and I, we have a date night every week. We love that time together, and we love seeing movies, so we go see movies a lot. This past week, we went and saw this movie that's out in theaters right now called Boyhood. Some of y'all might have seen it. Some of y'all haven't heard of it at all. It's a pretty fascinating movie because in the movie Boyhood, they actually film these different family members for 11 years straight. And so you actually get to watch this boy grow up on screen from about the age of 7 or 8 to 18 or 19. It's fascinating. But there's this part in the movie toward the end, and I promise this isn't going to ruin anything for you. But there's this part toward the end where this boy's mom just kind of breaks down and bursts into tears. And she begins to walk back through all the high points in her life. She's talking to her son. She says, there was the day your sister was born, and then there was the day you were born, and then there was the day I graduated from college, and then there was the day that I got this great job. But what do I have left in my life? The next thing for me is just my funeral day. And then she says this, I just thought there would be more. You know what that is? That's the cry of someone who has gone through life and never truly lived. See, William Wallace is right. Every man dies, not every man really lives. What's going to keep you from getting to the end of your college career and ultimately your life? What's going to keep you from getting to the end and saying, I just thought there would be more? The answer is beyond the sun, I promise you. The answer is beyond the sun. The answer is Jesus Christ. Let's pray together. Maybe you're here tonight and you're a believer in Jesus Christ. I want you to hear this. If you consider yourself a Christian here, please hear this. And I want to say this gently and with love. But I think one of the reasons skeptics of Christianity want to have nothing to do with our God is because we express way too much interest in their God. We express way too much interest in the God of money, the God of sex, God of significance, the God of stuff. As believers in Jesus Christ, we know the one who is beyond the sun, who truly can satisfy. So our lives should look different. They should. You're a believer in Jesus Christ, and man, maybe you've been making something other than Jesus. You've been making someone or something else God. I just want to invite you in this moment to confess that to God in the quietness of your own heart, to repent and just say, Jesus, would you forgive me? And I want you, Jesus, to be my God. If you're here and you're not a Christian, every single person here begins a relationship with God the same way. Everyone begins a relationship with God by coming to a moment where you realize who Jesus is and what he has done for you. That Jesus Christ, in fact, is God who came from beyond the sun. He died on a cross. He rose from the dead so that we might live. If you've never begun a relationship with Jesus Christ, then I'm telling you the best thing you can do tonight is look beyond the sun to Jesus Christ and say, Jesus, I want you to come into my life. I want you to be my Savior. And I want you to begin to lead me to life to the full. Band's going to lead us in the song that we sang at the end of last week. We're just going to declare tonight, Jesus is better. So you take this time, you do business in the quietness of your own heart with God. And if you want to sing with us and just declare Jesus is better, we're going to sing.